Accession number 13359, Mr. George Richardson, reel 10.
Mr. J.S. Richardson, reel 10. What time in the morning did you set off on a journey for any particular day's routine?
Well, on that trip, it was as soon as sun up. Of course, day rise and day sunset were more or less the same time, but I would say that by 6 o'clock we were up for the valley, breakfast, tents and everything packed onto the wagons, and then ready and set out for just shortly after 7 o'clock in the morning. We would cross and probably stop between noon and 1 o'clock for a brew up and a packed lunch that the quartermaster's already given us to set out with, and then carry on until probably 5 o'clock in the evening, when we'd be at the next station, camp, and about an hour or an hour and a half after camp, the quartermaster would have cocoa sounded and would go off for what they had to offer, which was a very quick meal made by the our mobile coach. Colonel Sergeant Handel used to manage to rally up, and of course it was the quickest meals they could get. Usually main course, bully beef mixed up with other food like that. And once we settled in, they would check all MTOs. All transport would be checked over by the MTO and his crew, ready for setting out the next day. In the evening, all platoon officers would go around and have weapons inspections, and there was nothing much to do. We bedded down, and on the first night outside of Banya, there was a raid on our camp by wargs from outside. I hope we're not going to get in trouble putting the wargs in. There was, I think, 2 brain guns and half a dozen rifles stolen. Well, there was a big outcry when this happened, and the CEO had a report of this raid. One lad had actually been dragged out of the tent with his rifle strap had been round his wrist. He had actually been dragged out with a knife held at his throat to stop him screaming. Nobody had been killed or anything, but with the loss of these weapons, Sayo decided to send some troops down into the nearest village, and they searched the whole of the village. And surprising the number of weapons that they found down there, more than what had been stolen that night, loads of them. They took quite a few prisoners and handed them over to our military police, who probably forwarded them on to Iraqi police eventually. But the orders from then on were that we had to double the guard at night, and also everybody had to sleep with a rifle inside the blankets with the strap to our wrist. The rifle strap was strapped to our wrist. On our second day, they took us for a special treat down into the Royal Air Force Station in Banya. All around was desert, but as soon as we passed through this massive wall, it must have been 12, 15 foot high, the wall around, we passed through these gates of the Royal Air Force on guard, and we passed into a little England. I've never seen so big a difference from one side of a wall to another. Outside was desert, inside was green. Green grass, green trees, all the streets were named Old Kent Road, all different names of places in London, along all the streets through in Albania. They took us down into the main square, disembarked, and they took us into a large theatre, film show, out of there into a big canteen run by the Naffy, a cup of tea and sticky buns, and managed a few minutes to just look around the station, which was a regular Royal Air Force station, and then back to camp before dusk. And then the following day we got prepared to go out on the journey, the last part of the trek. We went from there and got off the desert into more solid land, the river Euphrates and Tigris was up in that part. We went over one bridge where the previous year there had been a big flooding, was signs of flooding, and the roads were becoming, instead of being a desert track, were becoming more tarmac, but with a difference. They were all sticky, mostly with the heat of the sun, but also with oil. We were getting into oil country. Then we come to the outskirts of Baghdad. The whole brigade was stopped before Baghdad. I think it was the 8th Battalion got into the fighting order, full FSMO, and the brigadier had sent the 25 pounders, Royal Artillery batteries, forward with the foot troops, and the Royal Artillery on the main causeway through stationed guns pointing down each street. As the 8th Battalion went through, our battalion, the 6th Battalion and Brigade Headquarters and the supporting troops went through. We'd been told to put on our FSMO, steel helmets, armour rifles, and sit out. The sides of the wagons were being turned up, so it was sitting out, and we had to scowl and show that we were ready for action. When we went through, the troops were there, just muttering and things. They were all armed with long knives and arms slung over the shoulders, their kind of arms. We got to the other side of Baghdad. The 9th Battalion transport had come through with us. The 9th Battalion marched through, and with them went the artillery, and we all assembled at the other side of Baghdad. They must have formed this line of advance when we were back at Albania, because the brigadier was in full charge, and we did it as a brigade move. And we got through to the other side of Baghdad, all back onto the wagons, took off our equipment and made ourselves comfortable on the wagons, and carried on up to Kirkuk.
Did the civilians in Baghdad make any signs towards you?
They were looking vicious. They didn't have any cheese. They looked as though they were enemy who were passing through. So I think they were very correct to have... it was more or less as though we'd captured Baghdad without fighting, because that was what we were prepared to do. And went right from one side of Baghdad right to the other. Like that. We said it again, and I think we carried on the full day. I think it was about 66 miles away to Kirkuk, as far as I can remember. We arrived at Kirkuk at night and stopped just outside huge oil distilleries. As far as the eye could see, there's nothing else but oil refineries, oil distilleries, pumping stations, and oil wells. As far as you could see, massive. And dwell now, I can't remember much about the dwell now, it was where people lived. It was a massive place. We were there about 2 days. Then we were told that we had to march another, I think it was 88 miles, on foot, mostly. But I was lucky. I went with battalion headquarters and our signal stores. So I think I was at the march the last 10 miles. I had a drop off on the march the last 10 miles with the with one or two of the signals I'd cut saw feed and take off from them, and marched up to where we were going to be encamped on a out in miles from anywhere, just like the lower steps of Russia, we took it to be. And we found we were about 12 miles from Mosul, which was mentioned in the Bible as Nineveh, the old Nineveh in the Bible. And we were there some 3 months.
What was life like? Because this would be in November, December, January.
That's
time.
Right. We were there during, and we spent Christmas there. The nights got colder, and the days got shorter. Some nights I can remember it would snow, about 4 inches of snow during the night, and by 7 o'clock in the morning, the sun was up, the snow had all gone, and you could run around with KD shorts. It was quite warm, even in December and January. We had to wear extra clothing at night because it was bitter cold. Never known anything as cold as that. Two greatcoats, army greatcoats, and the guard was allowed to wear the leather jackets that the transport drivers wore. So we had one of those leather jackets over the top of our two greatcoats, and our heads covered over underneath our KD hats. That was when we were on guard at night. We lived in 14-man tents that were dug 4 or 5 feet down into the sand. The tents over the top, with steps down into one end, and then the flaps closed at night. For all the train during the night, we used to use old bean cans or old empty cans of some kind, and then in the morning just go out and throw them out onto the desert, and that would be too cold to go over the trains at night. I remember the old officer used to come down because he used to make sure that the we're all lying in our tents with our arms strapped to us inside. Of course, we had strong guards all around the camp. I remember the old officer came down our steps one night, probably 1 o'clock in the morning, just as somebody was going up with his gun, and he threw it over his belt that was coming down the steps, the old officer. So that was a big joke for in the battalion for the next few days. Who peed on the orderly officer? The training that we did there was, we had lines laid out. We had a battalion headquarters set up. We had a battalion signal office, static lines. Our lines were laid out. Signalers were sent out to all the companies. Lance Corporal and their signal head, each company headquarters. And during the morning, so at have company parades. Most of the places are being cleared of rocks to make parade grounds of some description. We had cross country runs, we had some football games. I remember we ran a, just before Christmas, we ran a platoon competition throughout the battalion. And our platoon, I think, got into the semi-finals. We didn't have any football game, we just our PT kit and our ordinary army boots to kick the ball around with. 5 mile cross country runs are regular. We couldn't march far, we were restricted to more or less the area we were in. The purpose of our being there, the way I understood it, was because the Germans were advancing through the Caucasus, coming through and heading towards that neck of Turkey that joined into the Middle East at the river just running through Mosul. We could see the Turkish borders, the hills just north of us. I suppose it'd be Kurdistan. I didn't know what to call it. Probably Kurdistan. They had a lot of Arab employed to dig a big anti-tank ditch along the Iraq-Iran border. That stretched for miles and miles and miles, and the engineers made pillboxes and gun emplacements right along there. It was supposed to be for a divisional stoppage in case the Germans did break through, because Iran were had quite a lot of German 5th Congress in. We knew that. And also they expected that if the Germans come in, Iran would just turn over and fight with, along with the Germans. So we would have been, our division would have been facing the German army in that section. For a special Christmas treat, they took us up into Mosul. Up in the morning, and we had to be back on the wagons at 5 o'clock. I bought a silver bracelet, which had been made, the melting silver trinkets and silver spoons and things like that down, made it into, I had a ring in the house somewhere, silver rings, and I've got this the shape of a coiled serpent, a snake, and I had it engraved inside. My girlfriend, pen friend, had the Genuith Law of Iraq, 1942, I think it was, 1941, Christmas 1941. I covered that over with wax, put it in the post, and she got it. And it was a few weeks before she rubbed the wax off from the inside and found out me had engraved on the inside. For a special treat, the brigadier, who had been, I think it was Brigadier Churchill, the regular army brigadier, and their commanding officers, decided that they'd go wild boar hunting down at the river, 2 or 3 miles down from where we were. There was a lot of marsh banks, tree lined, and they had quite a lot of wild boar run. And I was in battalion office when the brigadier was there, and I heard them say that it would take a few troops out to be beaters with fixed bayonets, with one bullet up the spout, but they weren't allowed to shoot. They had to be killed by the officers. That was the orders. It was a big game. And we went out, and there was one lad got mauled with one of the boars that attacked us. I think we finished up with 6 big boars. Huge big wild boar. And we had them for Christmas dinner. They shared them around the battalion. Quite a lot of pork extra to our diet.
Was your food pretty plain?
It was mostly hardtack. The bread that used to come up was very dry loaves, but they were mostly, because the wagons had a long way to come from base, covered with sand, usually, same as what they were up in the Western Desert. But we could always see the quartermaster's wagon coming up when they were miles away with the meat, because you could see the scavenger birds flying along. Shy dogs, or what they call them, them big. But they used to be, about a dozen of them used to be following the wagons up, because they could smell the dead meat inside the quartermaster's wagons, so we could see them coming. And we used to do a daily trip to our Army Service Corps along with our quartermasters, fetching the daily rations up.
Did you see much of any natives?
Just when we went in the morning. Oh, yes. Now and again, we would see flocks of sheep being driven and sometimes camel herds. And we were told that that was the shortest route to India, around the north end, around Kurdistan, around the top of Iran and into India that way. Apparently that's the way they're trading. They were allowed to go through our ranks, but usually when we saw the big caravan coming, they usually stood troops still to make sure that wasn't going to be any sneaking attacks.
Were you standing to and standing down morning and evening?
It wasn't until later on in the Western Desert that we did that. Although we always had stand tos and stand downs regularly, even when we were in Cyprus. It was normal. Even when we were in England, we practiced stand tos and stand downs. It was, I suppose, it was a thing that we'd got used to. Stand to would appear on orders, and everybody would stand to. All the roll calls checked in, and then stand down after half an hour. But up in Iraq, we had constant patrols going around. Not regimental guards, there were guards just going around fully armed in twos and threes, and just keeping any Arabs on. Iraqis or whatever from straying into our camps. We were up there all during that cold winter. We did quite a few exercises. We were given some Tommy guns around about then to supplement our Bren guns. So there's quite a few of the infantry given Tommy guns to, and they had to go out on target practice in and out what is firing at ready-made targets. Did quite a lot of small actions like that, exercises.
Was there a problem with boredom and the weather being cold?
The weather being cold at night, we had to, yes, but they never allowed us to get bored. Always kept us in action, always kept us doing something. I don't think any of the Durham Night Differs were allowed to get bored, any signs of boredom, and they would just take you out on a route march. They didn't believe in being bored, not us. No.
Did it affect morale, the long winter nights that you were there?
Well, there was quite a lot of squabbles. We had quite a lot of demotions through NCOs fighting between NCOs, those that were trying to be platoon sergeant and platoon sergeant that were trying to be sergeant majors. And so it happened. Oh, round about, I think we've been up there around about 2 months, and there was an outbreak of jaundice. But not one man, all officers, from the officers' messes, and I think about a dozen went down with jaundice, because they were living on rations that we couldn't get, Oh, but the ration was going to the officers' mess, and slim, margarine rations going to us. So they got jaundice and we didn't. And
were these things known to you, that the officers were eating better than you were?
I suppose some of the troops were muttering to themselves, but they didn't know as much as I did, for the simple reason that I was at battalion headquarters and close to the officers' mess most of the time. As a matter of fact, I spent some time working, because the officers' mess was large enough to have all the battalion officers in. And so I had to go up and assist in some of the officers' mess duties sometimes, when I didn't have any single duties on. Assist the sergeant to more or less just supervise the meals, because I wasn't a cook. But I wasn't a waiter either.
You've mentioned some of your signalling duties whilst you're in Iraq. Did the extreme weather conditions affect any of your equipment?
No, we had field telephones out, field lines, and because we were away from main roads, there was only the stretches where they come close up to the quartermasters, because most of our transport had been taken back to the echelons. We were more or less up there in front. It was only the CEOs and company commanders, chiefs and PUs that were up in the lanes. So we didn't have a lot of activity going to repair lanes. But everybody, quartermaster, all the company headquarters, MTOs, everybody had lanes out. I think we had sometimes three exchanges in folios, three 12-line exchanges in folios, just communicating to everybody that wanted to talk to everybody else.
What was your duty roster during, say, a day?
Well, the signal sergeant was in charge of our platoon. He only had a basic staff packet battalion headquarters, because there were two signals. Our platoon ran about 30 strong, with a platoon sergeant and corporals and lance corporals and signalers. So, with each company having two signalers out, that was ABCD companies, support company, and the MTO had a signaler. So, our battalion staff was mostly only had about 12 signalers and sergeant and corporals back. And we had to do all the maintenance and take our turnaround at manning the signal office.
How long would that duty be, manning the signal office?
Oh, it was usually 24-hour job.
What kind of signals were you getting in this static position?
Oh, the just general. Will you put me through to A Company Commander? So just ring A Company up and ask for the commanding officer, and usually from the adjutant, go through, sir, and just hear that we're talking, and pull our plug out. If they got to know that we were listening in, they soon found out, you know. We got a lot of information by just listening in now and again, but wasn't supposed to be done. It was against orders to listen into officers' conversations. We did get a lot of information, and anything that they wanted to spread around as general gossip, rumour, usually came from the signal office, or the buglers that were up at battalion headquarters. They'd be sitting in the guard room, and somebody would come out to the guard office and say, "And we're doing such and such and such tomorrow," and so that somebody outside could hear. And then that would fly around the battalion in no time. Rumours like that. But as a rule, any information that we knew that was just meant for between company commanders and adjutant and commanding officers, well, we've been trained not to talk.
You're a long way from home now. Was mail coming through regularly?
No, no, mail was a thing of the... We were lucky to get letters in less than 4 weeks that had been written. Very lucky. Even airmail, these small airmail that were transmitted quickly, even those sometimes took a month to come from England back home. Longer letters written in our green envelopes that were either censored or uncensored, like 6 or 7 weeks.